Today on the podcast we have the writer of Deconstructing Your Faith Without Losing Yourself. Her name is Angela Harrington. Joey manages to squeak in an intelligible question or two in this one, so that's a win already. Angela's focus, seen clearly in her book, is on supporting individuals during the deconstruction process, not on where they may wind up. In the book, Angela shows people how to begin healing religious trauma through deconstruction of faith. This concise and actionable handbook will guide people in vulnerable exploration and help with the release of unhealthy beliefs that cause harm. Begin your healing journey with Deconstructing Your Faith Without Losing Yourself by Angela Harrington. Let's go. I'm excited. My voice just isn't capable of showing that excitement.
And there are a lot of pastors who I know who come to me for coaching, or even pastors' spouses will come to me for coaching, and they'll say, I can't even ask these questions because we're part of the church and we're supposed to have a certain belief system. So when we're in a religious community and we know what the rules are and we know kind of how to fit into the box, and then all of a sudden we see someone who is outside of the box being pushed away, it doesn't take long for us to figure out that if we ask the wrong question, or if our doubt goes one step too far, we're going to lose that community.
I like demanded, pleaded, called God on promises and was like, you have to show up or like I am done. And he did. And he did.
That's something to really think about. What does it mean that the God of the universe loves me?
Are we saying that our God is bigger than their God or what?
Man, you got my mind going crazy right now.
I just think that that is evangelical bullshit.
And I don't fit in their box anymore. So feeling rejected from the church makes me feel far away from God.
If I'm living out the love of God, love of the divine, then in some ways we're unoffendable.
It's wrong to marginalize anybody for any reason.
Sometimes we can just have some things about our perspective that's off until we encounter someone who can challenge our thoughts, have conversations with us, and we just continue to grow and evolve.
I'm with you there. I like that.
That sounded like womp, 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 womp to rob you.
I'm a hardcore gospel lover. I do love the gospel. I just think we get it wrong.
Girl, I was so highly medicated, I don't even know if you
Oh, got my people.
Check, check, check. Welcome to the show. I'm Joey Stinson, and you're listening to The Pastor With No Answers, the mixtape era. On the air for 8 years now. 8 years ago, Obama was still president, for crying out loud. Check this out. Average lifespan of a possum, 8 years. So just think of it this way. When this show started, there's little baby possums coming out of their mommies, and now they're dead. 8 years later, they already lived a full life, maybe had kids of their own, maybe went through some separations and family conflicts, but those opossums are dead now. Got a thought experiment here. When someone for the first time was asked, hey man, how you doing? Somebody responds, do you think the very first time someone said, the other person said, what the hell did you just say? Like, where did come from? And how did get so popular and common? It's unbelievable. It's just a made up filler word that doesn't even really mean anything, but we all use it. And then I started to think, why Why not or rah? Or zuh? Hey man, how you doing? Hey man, how you doing? I mean, you ever wonder how stuff started? Like, imagine the first person who said, hey, those little pieces of bread are pretty good, but check out what I did. I put them in milk. It's real good that way. Fast forward. Now we have Frosted Flakes, Honey Bunches of Oats, Fruity Pebbles. Or the first time someone said the words, how about? What in the world does that mean? How about? Well, we know what how about means. I can't really explain it, though, how those two words have come to mean what how about means. So here's a little something about ancient language. And obviously, we talk about the Bible a lot. So let's look at the Bible on how daggum hard it is to have translated it all these years. If I told you once upon a time in a land far, far away, you'd know that I'm going to continue with a story. But it's because you know the combination of words that I use mean that. Oh, a story is about to be told. How about this one? I could care less. Well, you know what I mean. Somehow you know that what I really mean is I could not care less. I mean, imagine all the things talked about in ancient culture that we just don't know because we don't know what those combinations of words mean back in the day. So here's some words that I know what they mean, but my kids don't. And these words are becoming extinct. So if someone gets his ass kicked, a generation that came before me would say something like, he got licked. Now, if I said that to my kids, they'd be clueless. They'd be like, why'd that person lick them? That's very weird. I used the word malarkey the other day. My daughter didn't know what I meant. I don't use that word often. No one really does. I was being trippy. Soon, it will be seen as an old word that people said that was a courteous way of saying bullshit. Malarkey. Speaking of the word trippy, I said it the other day with my kids and they laughed because when I used it, I meant I'm being silly. I'm just being trippy. I'm just being silly. They said, Dad, if you're tripping or if you're being trippy, our generation hears that as like you're losing your mind or you're on drugs or something. Things are changing. It's so crazy. I'm watching sports nowadays, NFL, grown men, post-touchdown celebrations. I'm like, how old are these guys? And my answer to my own question is, oh yeah, they're youngsters. They grew up on cell phones. They score a touchdown. They're looking in the camera. They may be doing a TikTok dance for all I know. All right, back on track. So over the years, Pastor With No Answers has been a podcast in which, amongst other things, we talk a lot about spirituality, usually through the context of former or current Christian faith. Now, I really like the fact that some of the guests and conversations are way too liberal and progressive, while others are way too conservative. So obviously, sometimes it frustrates people, but over the years, I've just accepted that is what this show is. So obviously, podcasts aren't really podcasts unless someone is listening to them. You know, like if a tree fell in the woods with no one hear it, was sound made? If podcasts are made, no one listens, is it still a podcast? Anyway, through the course of many conversations, within that same conversation, I've thought, oh, that's going to hit hard for people who lean this way. Then the same sentiments about folks leaning the other way later on in the conversation about a different thought. So hopefully the only echo chamber you get with this podcast is an obsession with prioritizing love amongst people who actually still have faith, even if just childlike, that love could still be the only answer. So I wrote my patrons the other day telling them some changes and perks. I just wanted to make sure they were clear on some changes and got this response from a longtime supporter and friend I just loved. She said, as long as you continue to provide a place where, at the end of the day, different opinions can agree that love is most important, you will have my support. I'm happy just knowing such a community exists, and I appreciate everything you put into it. Warmed my heart. I was very appreciative. Thank you, Jennifer. So a quick note on this episode, I do always want to say I'm sorry about this. I think sometimes a conversation on this podcast can take on a cynical tone, and it's usually when I get with others who are on another side and standing on some common ground of deconstruction. This episode, it's like two people who have seen things that they can't unsee. And yet they're very much so aware of the many people that are still seeing things in a way that we personally feel needs to be unseen. But cynicism is never my intent. And my good friend Amy, one of the hosts of this show, reminds me to be a little careful. She's like an angel whispering in my ear saying, don't forget, have a loving tone. And then I have a little devil of a co-host, Hain, whispering in my other ear saying, give them hell.
Yeah, I'm in Indiana.
Okay.
Where are you at?
Charleston. Cool. All right. Well, Angela, thank you for joining. And when, go ahead and tell the listeners, we're talking about your book, Deconstructing Your Faith Without Losing Yourself. Your name is Angela Harrington. And tell us, when did this book just come out, or are we still pre-ordering or what?
Yeah, so the book actually officially goes out into the world on February 20th.
Yeah.
Well, congrats. Thank That's a you. Big deal. Is this your first book that you've written?
It is. It is my first book. And I wanted to write a book for a very long time. And I'm really glad that I didn't write a book 10 years ago.
You don't know how many people I've heard say that.
Yeah.
So many people. Yeah. Because you don't know what you don't know. And when you're 10 years younger, you're just thinking, well, I have all the answers now. Well, I'm going to wait.
Yeah. I would be issuing some retractions, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, I love that you're, thank you for sending me a copy.
Sure.
You know, there's a lot of, I consume a lot of books that has to do with the theology, I guess, behind deconstruction, which you do get into some, but it feels like a handbook for not only, and you push back because I haven't been able to give it a thorough read, but it seems like this would be not only a helpful book for those who are deconstructing, but for family members who love their family member who's deconstructing. Like, it really feels like if my mom is freaking out about my faith and I were to hand her this book, it feels like it would be a graceful way to share, hey, this is what's going on in my heart, Mom. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, it'd be probably a good read for those people.
Yeah, I didn't write it with that intent,
sure.
But it totally warms my heart that you say that, right? Because people who are in deconstruction, a lot of times you're getting pushback from loved ones who are genuinely worried, but don't actually know what deconstruction is. And there's a lot of books out there that are really just not based in a lot of fact and are really inflammatory about deconstruction. So that would be a really cool way for somebody to use this.
Yeah, cool. Isn't it great? Like, have you noticed, because everybody follows different sorts of things, but have you noticed, and I think you just mentioned a little bit of how there, and I kind of through my cynical days, so even though this sounds very cynical, I don't mean it this way, but it's like they're just talking about deconstructing now, and they're warning their flocks about deconstructing, and it's like they've got the devil's horns on deconstructing. And here's the misconception, in my opinion, of the people who are unkind and unloving to those people like us who've deconstructed or in the middle of deconstructing. It's more, I'm afraid that you're going to go to hell. The misconception is these are bad people. They're judgmental people. They're hateful people. Some of them are. But I would say most of the people we have tension with, it's because they're deathly afraid that we're going to burn in hell forever.
Yeah. I think that one of the most challenging things that we have to navigate during deconstruction is how much we've been conditioned by most churches to try to stay within the lines, because that's what's sacred. That's what's holy, right? Ask questions, doubt, wonder, but only within this container. And so when our loved ones see us asking questions that would have normally been off limits, or perhaps reading books that were considered heretical, like I do think a lot of it comes from a genuine concern. I think the only exceptions to that would be the people who are probably a little higher in the food chain, who have the resources and have the positions as leaders and should be going out and doing the research on this, right? Should be talking to people and observing rather than just saying, this is awful. This is dangerous. Yeah, I get called heretic on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
But it's by people who just aren't in a position to where they can be vulnerable enough to actually listen.
Yeah.
To my experience and the experience of the people I've worked with.
So I'm going to give you a quick snapshot of myself. Then I would love for you to do the same. I think in these sort of conversations is typically kind of helpful for our listeners also to kind of hear where you and I are. But I've kind of thought to myself, you know, Alan, especially people that I love and know well, because we all know the terminology fully deconstructed and all that. I think of fully deconstructed as someone who no longer considers themselves a Christian. I would say I've deconstructed about as far as you can while still believing as a Christian. And I even work I've been a pastor at a church now since 2005. And I would not say that it's a super progressive church. Now it is a very love first church. And I can say from the inside, we are really trying to do things the best that we can. Like our heart is trying to do the right thing, put it that way.
Yeah.
But if I had anybody in my church family, and we do talk about this thing, and that's why it's a special church, because people like me are allowed to be there. But if somebody says, hey, look, how can you believe that Jesus saves everyone? I don't know if that's your perspective or not, but it is mine.
Now, I would say, look, I can get into the weeds with you a little bit, but here is a book of someone 100 times smarter than me who covers all the scriptures, answers all your questions. Doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be convinced, but mm-hmm. like you just said, why don't you read something? Like you're interrogating me for something that you're calling heresy. You trust me. You know who I am. You know yeah. that I've got genuine intent when it comes to my faith. Why don't you read some of the stuff that I'm reading?
Yeah. And I think that's really revolutionary, right? Because so much of the structure of religion is that you find someone who knows more and just kind of lean into what they believe. Mm-hmm. And so even saying like, hey, I have a lot of feelings about this. I have a lot of beliefs about this, but here are a few of the people I'm reading on this particular topic puts the onus back on us as individuals to do the work and to really sit with it rather than just taking, you know, someone else's belief system and kind of putting it on like a hat or a scarf or a piece of clothing that seems like it fits for this season. Right. So I love that. I think that's a great way to do it.
Yeah. And then even more problematic is we see these people who we need to learn from as the authorities of the stuff that we're needing to learn. And no one ever tells us that we're not supposed to be certain about this, about yeah. these things that we have faith in. Like, I don't know if you've heard of Pete Enns, but he wrote The Sin of Certainty and just how mm-hmm. certainty is not what God was after. But here, I tell you what, if I'm getting ahead of myself, give us a snapshot of your life. How'd you grow up? When yeah. was kind of the beginning signs of you, you know, it's kind of one of those moments where you're like, okay, wait a second, something's not lining up. And then it's domino effect typically.
right. I'm here in the Midwest. I'm in the very, yeah. very conservative, mostly rural kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps sort of vibe. In the Midwest, I didn't grow up in church. I grew up around it. So I had grandparents that were very devoted, especially the women, very just pillars in their community and their faith community. So I was the VBS kid. You know, I would go to grandma's church for Easter, those kind of things, but didn't really grow up in the church, but was definitely steeped in some of the stuff that is just normalized here because yeah. it is predominantly Christian and predominantly conservative, even bordering on fundamentalist in a lot of the little pockets around the state. And so it wasn't until I was an adult that I went back to church. My husband and I kind of have a similar story of growing up around the church. So as adults, we were like, this is good. We should do this for our kids. And I loved it because I had moved a lot as a kid and I was always an outsider. And so when I went to this church, like all of a sudden there were rules. And to me, it didn't seem legalistic. It was like, okay, here's the path I can follow to belong. Oh, and it's also good for my soul and it's good for my kids and all these other things. And after being there for several years and just really learning a lot and getting into leadership and kind of seeing the behind the scenes stuff, it started to crumble a little bit. But I would say I didn't really chalk that up to belief system. I didn't really chalk that up to God or to Christianity. I just thought it was just this church. So we went to a different one, more progressive, you know, went from rural to a kind of a downtown church, totally different. One was denominational, one was not, and still saw some pretty big cracks behind the scenes. And so it was kind of like, if these churches are so radically different, how is this happening? Right. Mm. So we kind of slid into a third church on fumes. Like there wasn't much left in the tank. And I remember telling my husband on the way to that church, like, if this doesn't work out, I'm done. And people have asked me, done with God, done with church? I'm like, I don't know. Yeah. Like, I really don't know. I just knew in that moment that I was hanging on by a thread. And
some scary stuff, isn't it, when you feel that
yeah,
way?
Yeah. Oh, you're just like, gosh. I don't know. Right. So we slid into that church. Man, they cared for us so well. Really, really cared for us so well. And I still consider it my home church, even though there are a few things that doctrinally I'm not 100% on board with. Spent several years there and then went to seminary. So yep. how did I really get into deconstruction? I went to seminary and had to really bump into some of those challenges of like, we're in a denomination that affirms women in leadership. But when I was working on my master's thesis, these women who were very high in leadership were having really wonderful private conversations behind the doors with me and just saying, yeah, I still get left out of meetings. I still get talked over. I still get called hun in a board meeting. Like,
hun?
You know, just,
oh my gosh. I know. Yeah. Good Lord.
Yeah. Just those things that I was like, I always thought I could just outwork them. I thought if I was a better student, if I like proved myself, then those things wouldn't be an issue. And so I had been deconstructing for a long time without the language, but it really came to a head when I was in seminary. And the kicker, the thing that I think leads a lot of us to deconstruction, is when we realize that something is kind of harming us, we start saying, what else could I be getting wrong? Right? Like, what else is the church getting wrong? How am I harming other people? And so that's the very short version of a long and winding road that kind of landed me here.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so where is here? When someone says, hey, well, what happens to people when they die? Are you even a Christian? And I know for many people, and for good reason, these questions are either annoying or maybe even counterproductive, but help us as much as you can so people know, hey, am I listening to someone who's fully deconstructed or still a Christian? What does she believe?
Yeah, so whether I'm a Christian or not totally depends on who you ask.
Sure. Okay? Yep.
I have some really conservative friends that are like, nope, sinner, no way, going to hell. And then I also have some really progressive friends and friends who aren't Christian that are like, dang, dude, you are still steeped in it, right?
Right.
I do consider myself Christian. I still believe in a lot of the things that I used to believe in, what I would say I was all in. I think the difference is that I don't think God is quite as small as what I used to think God is, right? Like it doesn't feel as definable. And I've definitely
Forward, you're not going to tell me that God is bigger than the Bible, are you? Please don't tell me that.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe I'm not there yet. Right. I think the biggest thing for my deconstruction was just letting go of the absolutes, because absolutes felt like safety, right? Those were those rules. And I knew that if I was within the, you know, if I was on the right side of an issue, that was good. That was holy. But certainty isn't holiness. And so I would say that there's a lot more nuance and gray area. I would say I'm also much kinder. And oh my gosh, a bajillion times more aware of my own privilege in the religious systems and also just in culture as a whole. And I think that I allow more responsibility for upholding that system to land on my shoulders than I ever did before.
Yeah.
But just the suffering I've seen over the last, you know, since 2016, maybe even before that, of a lot of people who I trust inherently, just so deeply trust, the suffering that I've seen them go through, not standing up for that, it is not okay. And I think that in the past, I got a free pass a lot of times because of being a white, middle-class, highly educated woman with a traditional family, heterosis, all the things. I think that grieves me a lot more than it used to. Not that that's who I am, but that I benefit from those things in ways that are harmful to other people.
Yeah. And I mean, we could do a whole episode on what I'm going to dip our toes into right now. What really factors into this is, you know, you and I think would both agree. We would both be like, yes, certainty was not the intent of all this. I feel like we're all going to be in a season of, Lord, I believe, but help me with my unbelief. Like we're not going to find that sort of certainty. But if hell exists and there's a place where you're tortured forever, it's our human nature to have certainty, you know? And I think that is the cycle that I was on for so much of my life, is I read that you needed to have this certain form or certain level of faith to attain salvation. Yeah. And oh yeah, if you don't, then you suffer forever. So I was in this cycle of, but how do I know? How do I know that I'm saved? How do I know that God heard me? How do I know this stuff is true? Like the first step for me was hearing an annihilationist point of view of hell. And I went back to that place where you said, like, what else is there that I could be getting wrong? Because I'm hearing this theologian way smarter than me making a case for annihilationism. And I'm like, I just always thought it was like a forever sort of thing. And then from there, you know, so where I am right now, Angela, it just does not make any sense to me at all that a loving God would create all of this stuff and have any sort of, hey, and it's on you to figure something out in order for you not to be punished forever and ever. Like that, it just doesn't line up anymore. There's such a big disconnect. But Would you agree that fear is what keeps people from deconstructing? Because we're also warned, hey, beware of the wolves in sheep's clothing who are going to try to lead you astray. Do you want to go to hell and burn forever by touching, you know, these sorts of things? So was that something that you had to overcome personally, is the fear?
Yes, I think the fear is definitely a piece. For me, I was really lucky because, I grew up around church. So
yeah, that's right. That's right.
I wasn't going to lose my parents. I wasn't going to lose my grandparents. Like those people are still in my life. And the funny thing is we rarely talk about religion. So that was a buffer for me, right? I also was in ministry, but it was online ministry, kind of in my own space. And so I didn't have to worry about losing my job from saying the wrong thing. And there are a lot of pastors who I know who come to me for coaching, or even pastors' spouses will come to me for coaching, and they'll say, I can't even ask these questions because we're part of the church and we're supposed to have a certain belief system. There's two different kind of lanes that fear goes down. One is the not having the right answer and not knowing what I believe, right? That's the first one. But the other one that I actually think it's harder on people to navigate is the way that belonging is weaponized. So when we're in community, when we're in a religious community and we know what the rules are and we know kind of how to fit into the box, and then all of a sudden we see someone who is outside of the box being punished, being pushed away, gosh, in the last few years, being made fun of on TV, right? Like trolls on the internet, all the things. Yeah. What it doesn't take long for us to figure out that if we ask the wrong question, or if our doubt goes one step too far outside of the box, we're going to lose that community. And I think a lot of people experienced that in 2020 when a lot of us couldn't go to church. They started feeling better and they're like, wait a second, I'm not in my community right now. Why do I feel better? And so that fear kind of there was kind of a timeout and the fear was put on hold. But yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Fear is a limiting factor and also a driving factor for just human behavior in general.
Yeah. And I don't think I ever felt real freedom to continue my honest journey of deconstruction until the bulk of that fear was gone, because I just didn't believe that way anymore. Otherwise, I don't think I would have had the courage to continue. I think you'll love this. I think that'll warm your heart a little bit. So a couple of weeks ago, I was telling my friend just a couple days ago that, and I don't think I'll ever totally, I think eventually, but I'm 46 years old and I still have like a little knee jerk reaction of, you know, fear when it comes to certain things, especially, you know, I've got a 17, 15 year old girls, 13 and 11 year old boys, and the vast majority of their most impressionable years, I was scared shitless, deconstructing and not knowing what to teach them. My oldest daughter's the only one who remembers me trying to explain hell to her. And I would say, you know, when she was probably 3 or 4, I started being like, I just don't even know. And so now I'm completely fine with it all. I've been a great father. But if I would look at how I have been as a father, or if somebody would have told me that I would have not basically indoctrinated these kids and make sure they believe everything perfectly, I'd be scared. I'd be like, oh, shoot. Well, what did I even do as a father if I didn't give them that? And I felt the most calming, peaceful, all I can put words to is the Holy Spirit basically saying, do you think I feel this was God? So, and could be, could not, it could have just been something cool that came to my heart, but more of a, do you think I'm this disconnected from you, my creation, to where I saw that you were incapable of the sort of guidance that you wanted to provide your kids? And so I'm just going to turn my back and be like, well, all of Joey's kids are going to go to hell because he was stuck in a place where he just wasn't. And I told Hayne, my buddy, who's a co-host on here, I'm like, we are all effed if that's how God operates. I mean, if we take literally things like you're lukewarm, I'll spew you out of it. We're all screwed. Like we're completely screwed.
Right.
But that's been, if I didn't have kids, I think my deconstruction process would have been a good bit less scary.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, again, that's part of the church training, right? That if we, if we fall off, if we decide not to do the work to take the narrow path, not only are we at risk, but our children are at risk. And and especially when you're in a leadership role outside of the home, okay, now you're a pastor, your congregation is at risk. There's a few people who are very loudly anti-deconstruction who they're looking at all of those who are all of those of us who are providing safe spaces and saying that we're intentionally trying to lead people out of the church just because. because we're getting those jollies, right? And it just gets, there's this responsibility, but also this lack of autonomy that we get stuck with in the church, that it's just, it to me, it doesn't align with a compassionate, generous creator. If we were created, if a creator is love, if that creator made us, how could we not have a few grains of that within us, right? At least, at minimum. Right. And so to have to jump through those hoops and prove that we're worthy in a system that was set up by someone who just wanted us to prove that we're worthy of love so that they could feel love, like, hi, that's codependency.
Yes.
That's not faith. Yes. Right. That's not being Abba Father. That's not being any of those things. That's not being, you know, God the Mother. God, like,
yeah, that's an abusive being saying, if you don't have the right faith, or if you don't love me, I'm going to punish you. We would say that's the most horrible, abusive person ever if that was a human being. Hey, if you don't love me, I'm going to torture you. We'd be like, well, that's a sadistic maniac. But with God, his thoughts and ways are higher than ours.
right. And even for people who are like, yeah, that's really cruel, there are even kind of this middle ground of people who are like, okay, well, it's not God punishing you. Like, it's just God not saving you. And I'm still codependent. Like,
yeah, you believe in a very, very small God. If I love you enough,
then you'll rescue me? Like, come on. Yeah. That's not good.
So when I talk about fear and my kids and all of that, I think that exposes another assumption or the main assumption that people have of folks in deconstruction. And that is that we're this rebellious group who just don't want to conform anymore. We want to poke holes through things because maybe we don't want to have a God that we yield to and obey and all of that. And I'm like, I did not choose this scary path. Now, I'm glad now that I walk through it because I'm more freer than I've ever been. But when that stuff started, there's no way I would have chosen that. I mean, I was very, very scared, like very scared to start letting go of things. Because, I mean, once I started doubting things about hell, I'm like, well, is any of this true? Because that seems to be one of the bigger things that I believe. But it's not a rebel thing. Angela and Joey Svensson, right now, we want, here's what I'll tell you that we want to do. We want to do what's right. If there's a God of love out there, we want to do exactly what that God of love says. Because we, you know, if there's a creator of love, sign me up. I want to follow that creator that loves me. We want to follow this being, you know, I mean, it's not an act of rebellion.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I think the piece I would add to that is that I don't want to worship this divine being that wants me to throw you under the bus for my own salvation. So when we talk about really, really ugly things like racism and homophobia and transphobia and xenophobia and let's celebrate refugees, you know, this little piece of the year, but when they're at our border, we don't want that, right? That's criminal. Like I don't want to have to be cruel to feel a connection that's holy and sacred. To me, those things are not possible. That it's not that they're even just a little bit dissonant, right? It's like a light being on and off at the same time. And I don't love absolutes, right? I just, leaning into absolutes, I think gets us in trouble. But I would say if there is one absolute that I believe about faith and about Christianity or any other faith, is that if I have to actively harm others or passively harm others by benefiting from their suffering, it's not something I want to be a part of, right? Like, how is that going to make me whole? How is that going to sanctify me? And if we want to use really churchy words, right? Yeah. How is that going to lead me to a place of humility and compassion and, like, go through all the Beatitudes, those aren't there if I'm throwing right. you under the bus just so that I can stay safe in the afterlife.
Well, let me ask you this. I agree with your sentiments. I'm going to play a devil's advocate that I don't agree with, but I know what a lot of people would say, and they would say, Angela, this, so for the record, I'm gay affirming as well, but let's pick on a gay person, and someone sure. says, hey, I love this gay person. There's no way I can accept this lifestyle because it's bad for them. It would be unloving if I did accept and say, you're fine. Now, I love them. I'll serve them. Mm-hmm. I'll be a friend, but I cannot condone. Well, that lack of condoning is what the sort of hurt that we're talking about is, the sort of harm, because it is very right. harmful. But I think for a lot of well-intentioned Christians, it's a belief system. I love that person. I'll give you an example, and I need to be very careful. One of our best friends, her husband died tragically in 2012. She realized that she kind of went both ways, and now she just ended up marrying a woman. So now we're close friends with her wife as well. Well, my parents, they've known these friends of ours for a while. They don't know her wife that well, but I mean, they know their kids. They know this family. Mm-hmm. My parents don't have 1 ounce of mean thoughts towards Liz. They don't think she's a bad person. They're not disgusted by her, but there's no way my parents would ever say we support Liz being married to a woman, because that would be harmful for them right. to approve of that. That's a mess, isn't it, Angela?
It is. It is. And I think a lot of that comes down to white saviorism. And there are people who are listening that are like, what the crap? That's not even
remote. Where did that come from?
Where did that come from? Okay. But let's walk this back for just yeah. a second. The reason that there's so much focus on air quote lifestyle is because there's so much focus on saving people from themselves. Right. So if we believe that all humans are innately weak and broken and just effed up, mm-hmm. then it is cruel to let them live in that and not know that there is hope for being cleansed and sanctified, whatever denomination you're in, use whatever words, right?
Yeah.
Not trying to start a denominational war yeah. here. Yeah. But honestly, that's what as a parent, like, we're parents. So if we know that that's what our kids were born with, why wouldn't we want to show them something better? Okay. The problem is assuming multiple things, that the choices that people are making are sinful just because they're different than my choices. Right. I mean, the same thing. I could say you have a beard. I don't have a beard. I'm really worried about you because of that. And here I am trying to save you from whatever suffering I think is related to you having a beard, right? Mm-hmm. The yep. reason that it's white saviorism is because we are trying to get people to assimilate into the core of who holds power in the church. And it's okay if you're listening and you want to rewind that like 3 times. We just jumped the Grand Canyon, okay?
Yeah.
Anytime I'm pressuring people to assimilate into my belief of what is perfect and right and good and holy and worthy of God's love, that is idolatry, because I am idolizing what I believe. I am idolizing my version of what will save them. And it never turns out well, because the people who we're air quotes trying to save are automatically devalued because we are placing ourselves above them. You know, if people want an example of this that's really cut and dry, easy to see, go back and look at the Indian schools. Look at how we literally, as churches, funded and committed murder, not just cultural genocide, but the murder of human beings
yeah.
in order to save them from their culture and their spiritual heritage, which mm-hmm. we automatically devalued because it wasn't white Eurocentric Christianity.
Yeah. Now, do you think the people who are doing this idolatry would you say they are being deceived? And I'm not making any excuses. I think that I'm trying to always find some footing. Like if God tells us, I don't consider these people that we're referring to as enemies, but I do know that God wants me to even love my enemies. So I'm always trying to find some footing, to find some sort of empathy or mercy, not at the expense of fighting, you know, for justice and for people who are hurting. Does that make sense?
For me, where the mercy and the compassion comes in is I can grieve what people don't know.
Yeah.
I can grieve a life that is so closed off that they will never know the richness of all the stories that they can't be exposed to because they're not safe to be around.
Yeah.
Right. And coming from a really humble place, we have to be honest that it could be any of us. And at some point, for those of us white, educated, you know, middle class people, in some way, we're still doing harm. So we have to be really careful not to other the people, like you said, enemies, right? People who are doing harm, we need to be confronting that harm without dehumanizing the people who are doing the harm. And I say that with a ton of privilege, right? Like for people who are pushed further and further to the margins of the church, I'm not going to tell you how to do it because your situation is way more risky than mine.
Right.
So I'm predominantly talking about people who kind of are at the same level in the hierarchy that you and I are. Vilification is a waste of energy, and it just flips us from being like the people who are being persecuted to the people who are persecuting. And that's not holy and sacred. I mean, it's not. So I think we can be compassionate without, by recognizing the humanity in the people who are doing harm without giving them access that they haven't proven safe enough to earn.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. Yeah, because I feel like one of the biggest things that I've been released from is not having to see everybody as in or out. Like, that is not something I reveled in. Like, when I hear people say blessed and highly favored, God's chosen, all that stuff, I'm like, how can you be happy about a father figure who is showing favoritism? Like, I don't understand those sorts of sentiments. And to be rescued from having to see every single human being, from my closest friends all the way to a new person that I, you know, met walking in the neighborhood for something, I don't have to think of them as, I wonder if they're going to go to heaven or hell. To be rescued from that and to actually really believe in a God that is way bigger in or out has just been such a blessing.
I mean, we saw this a lot when Jesus and John Wayne came out, and there's some other books that have kind of the same track. We're seeing so much Christian nationalism, and what a lot of that is rooted in. Yes, it's colonialism, it's white supremacy, but it's all like wrapped up in this hyper toxic masculine bow. And so what we see is that the more culturally we lean that way, the more we assume God is that way too, which then means we lean that way more, right? Like it's a cycle that feeds itself. And so I think that one of the things I'm really hoping happens, one of the things I hope happens with this book is that people get to take a little baby step back from that and recognize that things that are energetically feminine, you know, things like nurturing and compassion and some of those things that are often seen as, you know, women's weakness, we recognize that we could not have been created by someone who didn't have that. Right. Mm-hmm. And so talking about, I use the word mothering in here, in the archetypal sense of someone who's nourishing and caring, right? In a hyper-masculine space, being more masculine, being more forceful, overtaking the air quotes enemy just keeps the spiral going. So what we need to do is we need to learn how to find that balance and how to take a step back from the battle plan. Like don't build a battle plan. Take a step back and heal where you're wounded, not your brokenness. I'm not saying we're broken, but I'm saying find the spaces that have not been cared for in yourself and figure out how to heal those, and also figure out how those unhealed spaces are harming the people around you, because they probably are.
Yeah. That's great, hon. You're doing a great job. That was a joke, complete joke.
All the listeners just went,
yeah, yeah. Did Joey just call her hon? Did he just not hear what she said about business meetings?
Yeah, I'm
having a hard time wrapping my mind around that. I could not imagine being a woman in a business meeting with peers, her equals, and then her being called a hon. All right.
I can actually top that. I had a professor at seminary who used to send, instead of giving feedback in writing, he would just record a message. And I loved it because I'm a verbal processor.
Yeah.
And he would call me hun and he would call me sweetie. And at the time, I didn't even get it. To me, it felt like insider language. Cool, we have a relationship. And then later I was like, what? Like, why didn't I see that? Well, because you're conditioned to be grateful.
Right. Yeah. That's so true. Now, I would say there is some cultural facets of that kind of lingo. And in the South, for instance, I mean, you may go into a store and this sweet gentleman of a 60-year-old man who's just a great guy, great husband, he calls you hun because he sees you as a young lady, you know? Mm-hmm, and that's not the kind of stuff that I'm like, oh, he should never say hun. I think we should be smart enough to know hearts behind it. But yeah, the hun in the workplace definitely seems like, hey, you're below.
Because there's a power differential.
Right, exactly. Right?
So in this, like, I'm totally not offended that you made that joke. I think it was hilarious. But in this conversation, because I'm on your podcast, you have a little more power than I do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's different than, you know, being the cashier at the store or, you know, the sweet old guy that opens the door for you at church. Like, the hierarchy matters, I think, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Here's how I'd love to wrap this up is in part two of the book, Mapping the Wilderness. I'd actually like to read every single line of the title of chapters. And maybe what you can do is either give, like, I'm literally thinking maybe 30 seconds to a minute on each of them, but I don't want you to overthink the timing at all. But I would love for
you
to
either... Let me get my timer going.
Yeah, yeah. Now, don't worry about the time. That'll be my job. But I would love for you to either give like a snapshot of what the phrase means or maybe an example. But I'm just wanting to give people a really keen sense of what they will read if they get this book. And so the first one is... commit to embodied curiosity.
Yes. The Cliff Notes version is that so many of us were taught by religion and by high control relationships that our bodies are risky and untrustworthy, especially women, especially our queer and trans brothers and sisters. Like, we've been taught that if we listen to our body, it will lead us astray to the point that we're dehumanizing and calling it an it. Like, we're talking about this beautiful living part of us. So when we talk about embodied curiosity, first step is getting in your body and then getting curious and not trying to solve deconstruction from the eyeballs up. Yes, there's a lot of heady stuff in it, but if you don't learn how to get in touch with your heart and listen to your intuition and notice where trauma is sitting in your body, it's going to be a lot harder to make decisions. So the curiosity is being open-handed and saying, what else is there? And the embodiment is not just valuing your brain, valuing all of you and seeing the sacredness and the holiness of you wherever you're at, whatever stage you're at, no matter what, there is a spark of sacredness within you.
I love that. Yeah. And I feel like I've talked to some Christians who are scared because they were deconstructed. And I've told them, I'm like, look, the stuff that you believed about salvation, you know, we may get to those later and think through why there is probably not the best explanation. But, you know, I think I've actually had someone say these words out loud, like, basically, do you not think that God wants you to be honest in this journey right now? And do you think because of your honesty, all of a sudden God's going to turn his back on his child? Like, basically saying, if what you believe about the gospel and being saved is true and you're secure, then you're still secure when you're on this journey of curiosity. Now, again, I think that some of the foundation of that is unhealthy and rooted in fear. But to even start the process, it's like, look, you don't have anything to be afraid of. If the God that you believe in as far as the love part, you don't have anything to be afraid of.
Right. If God is as expansive and as ununderstandable, I don't know if that's a word or not, but like yep. if we as humans don't have the capacity to understand the fullness of God, then why on earth would we be taught to pretend like we understand the fullness of God? Right. That's ego driven. That's not necessarily driven by the soul.
Gotcha.
The soul is curious. The soul is going to ask questions. The soul is going to say, wow, that feels weird. Or like, I used to believe that, but now I wonder. It's a different type of listening. We have to listen with our whole selves to get to a place of safety and healing. And so that's why, out of all the things in the book, that's why starting with that embodied curiosity, I think, is really important, really transformational, even if you're not deconstructing.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So the second chapter is lower your defenses. Would you say that has to do with like being offended by beliefs that don't line up with yours?
Yeah, some of it is like being offended by other people. But really, the heart of it is that we've been taught to build a fortified faith. And so in the book, I talk about like the old medieval castles and, you know, things that are built into the wall, into the sides of cliffs. They're not meant to move. But the part that we don't talk about is that there's also layers of that. And those fortresses are built to protect the highest level people of that hierarchy in the center. Us peasants out on the edges, like, are, you know, that first layer may fall, right? It's not an equitable structure. So lowering your defenses is really literally taking down some of those walls and letting them crumble and being vulnerable. Yeah. And recognizing that there is something completely sacred about vulnerability and not knowing that or not pretending that you're safe from every potential attack.
Yeah.
If anybody's been raised in apologetics, this one's for you. Like all of these are important, but if you've been taught apologetics, which is basically a battle plan to defend what you believe to be true about faith or what your pastor or whatever, this is going to be something that's really challenging. And it's also essential because all the information in the world will not help you if you automatically discount it and say, they don't know what they're talking about.
All right. So we'll hit the last two, but I'll go through all of them. You have examine and, or you have gather new and different information, examine and sort, reconcile and release, recenter on what is good. The last two, tell us about carry on with compassion.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to move through all these different stages. And there's something in the book that talks about how to do the gathering and the sifting and the sorting. But again, information, it's not a lack of information that's creating these unhealthy spaces. So when we kind of learn this process, we're going to need to repeat it over and over with every topic, potentially every belief. And that's why I say deconstruction never truly ends. And I also don't believe that most of us have to reconstruct. So when we get to the point where we've sifted and sorted out all the junk, rather than building something up in its place, what I really want to encourage people to do is releasing the junk and then allowing, like, recentering on what's good, because all of a sudden what's good now has space to expand. It gets to take up more space in your life because you've gotten rid of some of those toxic things.
Yeah.
And then the compassion piece, like, again, it's like embodiment. Like it is so drilled in our head that being self-compassionate is sinful. So yeah, we need to be compassionate with our neighbors and with the people in the world who are not getting their needs met. We also have to be compassionate with ourselves. Because if you want to go back to the Bible for just a second, how the heck do you love your neighbor as yourself if you don't love yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yep. Like, so you've got to learn how to be compassionate and how to weed out those voices that traumatized you. And that takes a while. So that's why it's a constantly ongoing process rather than here's your 10 steps. Once you're done, good job. Here's your certificate. Move on.
Yeah. All right, we'll close it out here with Deconstruct Without Losing Yourself. What I want to ask you specifically is there definitely, and I think you and I would probably vibe on 99% of stuff, but I'll almost embarrassingly admit that even a little out of my comfort zone, how you talk about self and self is all you need, self, like even a deconstructed Joey, I'm like, wait a second, I still need my creator. Like I have learned how important self is, self-management, self-love, self-mental health, and all of that. But, I still need God. Walk us through that.
So here's what's really interesting is that there's a lot of people who are challenging that because it feels selfish, right? Right. But when I talk about self, what I'm talking about is that we are not just a meat suit walking around. Mm-hmm. We're not just a brain that's valuable. And everything else is just, you know, the suitcase that we carry it in. If we really believe that there is a creator who created everything in all of the universes with love and with intent, how could we possibly connect with and honor that creator by saying that 90% of us is bad and not worth our attention? So, you know, we got to be really careful not to go into that spiritual bypassing where it's just like, go on a retreat and do these things and everything will be fine. And what I'm talking about is the deep healing work that comes from meeting your own needs, whether that's spiritual or emotional. You know, if you have parenting wounds, because parents couldn't be who you needed them to be, like that mothering piece is caring for self. And then once you have started to identify those pieces of you that needed to be cared for, what you'll notice is that it will spill out into other spaces, but you can only put out into the world what you have inside you. So if I'm walking around saying that I'm innately bad, and if I just work hard enough, then eventually I'll be holy enough that I'll be safe, or even if you don't believe in hell, but just, you know, I've got to earn this holiness, got to earn this, I don't know, approval. That's all you can put into the world. So when we're teaching our kids, what are they going to learn? You can tell them that God is all loving and forgiving and all the things, but what you're living out is frantically running around trying to not screw up because you don't want to go to hell.
Right.
So that discontent with self is exactly where I want you to be.
Yeah.
Because discontent means you're challenging some deeply rooted stuff that we didn't even know was there.
Ooh, I'm not going to add to that. That was too good. So we'll just wrap it up there. All right. So we'll have it all in the show notes, but what's the big day again? Did I remember
February 20th?
February 20th. Yes. Yep. Awesome. Do you have any more projects on the radar, on the horizon? That's like the question you ask authors. That's just as annoying as you just had your first child. No, when's number two?
Yeah, when's the next one?
I just had a daggum first one.
Well, I happen to be a very proactive person who is absolutely in love with writing and loves the work that I do. I took a bit of a sabbatical from coaching, just knowing that the book was coming. So yeah, there are discussions about what the next project might be. And we're having some discussions around here about opening back up coaching and being able to support people and bringing back the Deconstructing Faith Summit, which we did a couple of years ago and was a blast. So
nice.
Stay tuned. I can't give you all the answers now, but there will be answers.
Yeah, for sure. If someone's listening, they're like, man, I really like her. And if she does any coaching, I would love to have access to that. Is that something that you said you are starting to do again, or you already have something in place, or what?
Yeah, the best way to see what's available in the moment is to go to angelajharrington.com, cool. which I'm sure will be in the show notes.
Yep.
Right now, I have a lot of kind of self-paced workshops. There's actually a virtual retreat that was really great that talked a lot about calming your nervous system. Those are all on the website. Most of them are like $20, $30. So it's not like it's thousands of dollars or anything ridiculous. But being on my website, get on my email list. And then I also host a free Facebook group called the Faith Deconstruction Cafe. And I try to make sure that anytime something new is coming up, everybody in that group knows. So any of those spaces. There's some exciting, like I'm biting my tongue right now because there's some exciting things that are coming, but the cement isn't dried yet. So I got to get a little further down the road.
There you go. Awesome. Well, I appreciate you guys reaching out to me, and I appreciate you coming on. Again, congratulations, and thanks for being a part of such a good work. I mean, there's a lot of scared people out there, and they're scared because they were taught some very scary things.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thanks for having me on. I think that the driving thing that so many of us are working on is just help where you can. So my great grandmother used to say, help when you can, and that's the best we can do.